Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Three Questions. I am the host of The Three Questions, Andy Richter. And this week, I am talking to podcaster, comedian, former White House speechwriter. That's my first time talking to one of those. And now author, John Lovett. You know him as the host of Pod Save America and Love It or Leave It. As a speechwriter, he worked for President Barack Obama, as well as for Hillary Clinton when she was a U.S. senator and a 2008 presidential candidate. His book, Democracy or Else, How to Save America in 10 Easy Steps, is out this June. Get your tickets for John's many live dates at crooked.com/events. Here is my really fun and really interesting conversation with John Lovett. Well, thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Are you just plugging your...
Plugging in the book.
The book.
Plugging the tour.
Yeah.
And then plugging Vote Save America.
And
the pods.
And the book is Democracy or Else, mm-hmm. How to Save America in 10 Easy Steps.
That's right.
Were there 12 or 13 and you're just like, no, 10, it's got to be 10?
I'll tell you something. There were 9.
Ah, you had to think of another one.
And we were really stuck for a while.
Wow.
And then we figured out a 10th, which was, hey, take a break.
Breathe.
Yeah.
Just breathe.
Yeah, self-care.
Just breathe.
Absolutely. That was a real problem we had. Honestly, months.
Right, because you can't have 9 steps.
No, you can't have 11 or 12.
Yeah, yeah.
If we had 8, okay, but we were at 9.
And also the German language has ruined the word 9.
Right.
9!
Right, like sounds like you're desperate pleading. For something to stop.
Yes. And then you're going on tour with the podcast, right? With Love It or Leave It.
Yes. Love It or Leave It is hitting the road. We're going to a bunch of cities. We have a couple shows in April in DC and Austin. And then in June and after, we'll be across the country.
Nice. Now, do you think of yourself as a comedian who got into politics or a politics person who kind of branched out into comedy? Or is this something you talk about to your therapist and I?
100%. But we've worked through it, so it's a good timing.
Oh, good.
No, so when I always really liked comedy. I really liked politics. I actually really liked math. Those were the three directions I felt pulled in. And when I first went into politics, I had done some stand-up after college in a very amateur way. But, you know, when people find out in D.C., that you maybe know some way to write a joke. You have some sense of what a joke is. You know, it's like being a painter. You show up sober, they make you foreman. And so, it's really one of the most kind of like boomerish comments that you'll hear that I'll ever make. But
I like it.
Yeah.
I like it. My favorite of those is pay peanuts, get monkeys.
Hey, pretty good.
Yeah. That's one. My grandfather used to say that.
Here, ask me how many people work at Team Coco.
How many people work at Team Coco?
About half.
welcome to the dad talk.
But so I ended up writing jokes for Hillary Clinton very early on, even before I was a speechwriter for her. And it was a very big deal to me because I was on these calls with these speechwriters that had been professionals. Al Franken actually had gotten on that call to kind of pitch jokes. And I remember I made Al Franken laugh. It was a really big deal to me.
Yeah, yeah.
With a joke about Rick Lazio working in a deli. Rick Lazio having been Hillary's former competitor for the Senate seat. But I remember thinking to myself, John, don't let your head get too big. You're funny enough to be a funny professional, but you're not funny enough to be professionally funny.
Mm.
That was always what I felt, that I was good at several things, but not great at any one of them, that I was a pretty good speechwriter. I could write some pretty good jokes, but I was never going to be I was never going to really be able to turn that into being a true comedian. And then after a few years of being in politics, I had said that to one of my closest friends. And as I was thinking about moving to LA to try to actually focus on comedy, I reminded him of my imposition, like, tell me if my head gets too big because I think I'm about to try to be professionally funny. And I remember him saying, like, I never really believed that. I actually always thought you could be professionally funny.
Yeah.
And so I took a chance. But I've always felt uncomfortable calling myself a comedian. I felt uncomfortable calling myself a writer. I think a lot of comedians feel this way, but I just feel like because, yes, like, of course that would describe what I do. Every week I do jokes in front of a live audience all across the country.
Yes, exactly.
But somehow because I didn't get there the normal path, I feel like I didn't do my time to earn the name.
I think that's just a natural thing because I sit here and I think, well, the proof is in the pudding. Here's another dad statement. Mm-hmm. You know, you get, like you said, you get paid to be funny. You're on stage entertaining people, you know, whether it's with a, you know, sort of a chat show format or just on your own telling jokes. And great.
Well, you know what? That's the final boost I needed. It's done. Lock it in.
No, but I mean, I also understand it's easy for me to say that about you. And it's easy for people to say that about me, who sometimes I'm like, well, what have I really done, though? I mean, I sat on a couch and just kind of.
Oh, but man, you made that look easy.
You know,
you made it look easy.
But it's like, I know, but it's, I think that we tend to discount the things that we have a facility for. You know, like if it's kind of like, and I don't give myself credit for things unless it's like, I'm sweating and it's a struggle and I really, you know.
For sure.
You know.
You don't want to belong to any club that would have you as a member.
Kind of, yeah.
I feel that.
Yeah. So, and did you grow up in a very political household?
Not really,
I mean,
no.
It wasn't like a combo of funny and political?
No, it was just, it wasn't particularly political. It was I grew up on Long Island, Jewish parents. My father ran a box factory. My mother had worked at department stores and then became a homemaker. And politics was not a big part of our lives. It was much more about you do well in school, you got to go to a good college. It was the kind of ambition and drive of that kind of that sort of Jewish immigrant mentality. That was
And
the
was
vibe.
There a push for you to be a quote unquote professional of some kind?
Yes and no. To my parents' credit, so my father took over a box factory for his father.
Right.
And
he didn't expect you to take over the box factory?
Well, he saw I couldn't do it. I didn't have what it took. I couldn't fold the boxes. I couldn't figure it out.
Really?
No, I made a mess of them. No, he...
Because I'm disappointed in you already, you know, by proxy.
It was like Lucy with the chocolates.
Yeah,
it was like,
yeah. It's like you were shoving the boxes in your mouth as fast as you could.
Yeah, I was hiding boxes. I embezzled. I don't even know how to do that. I was terrible at it. No, well, that I think that he had felt like growing up, he was expected to do a certain thing, that he was going to take over the business for his father. And it was very important to my parents as a result that they were very supportive and they really wanted me to do well and they really cared about that. But sort of whatever I wanted to do, they were very supportive of me getting to choose what direction I would go.
Yeah, yeah. That's nice.
Yeah.
And did your mom work? I don't have that information.
She worked at a department store. She was a buyer for, I believe, A&S department stores. And then she was a homemaker.
Okay. Yeah. And what was your household like? I mean, was it a big family or you?
It was me and my sister and my parents. It was not a big family. It was very much, it was that love is, you know, it's a very kind of, you know, dating profile thing these days about the love languages. You know, there's acts of service and physical touch and gifts. This was a quality time. You know, we're going to go to Little League. We always were together, but it wasn't like it was sort of an old school, not very effusive.
Right.
Right? Like love is shown through acts of taking you places, caring, making sure things are where they need to be, making sure you're taken care of.
But not sharing deep feelings.
No, there was not that much of that.
Right.
And well, actually, so my great grandparents met at a school for the deaf.
Wow.
One of the first, or maybe one of the only schools for the deaf. And so they were both deaf.
Uh-huh.
And this was from long before there was preschool or anything like that. So their son, my grandfather, didn't learn to speak until he was a little bit older.
Wow.
So he was always kind of taciturn. He was not someone who did a lot of talking.
Yeah.
Wasn't an effusive person. His son, my father, grew up in a household.
With a guy that learned to talk late.
Right.
Wow.
And so you see how like you kind of can start at two people meeting at a school for the deaf like 100 years ago.
Wow.
All the way down. Yeah.
Wow.
To not being able to share your feelings in a long car ride.
Wow. That's amazing. Well, was that a problem?
No.
When you were young? I mean, did you feel like they don't understand me?
No. They're very, it's more, I think, that I was a bit of an outlier in my family. I think my sister is a bit more like my parents, and I love my parents and I love my sister, but I was always a bit of a careening, chaotic, emotional part of the family, and they're, I think, a bit more even-keeled. And so I think that figuring out that being enthusiastic and being passionate was going to be a big part of how I figured out what I was good at.
Okay.
Was something I had to kind of learn.
Right.
Because there was a much more kind of, I think, nuts and bolts. You get good grades, you find good college, you think about the career that's going to be best for you. You know, it's
right.
a pragmatic,
yes.
there's a pragmatic kind of safety
right.
of that way of thinking. And I thought like that for a long time. And I don't think there's anything wrong with thinking that way. But I got to a point where I was like, you know what? No, like I want to take some big swings. You know, I want to do speech writing, or I want to do comedy, or I want to move to LA. And I always decided that I would bet on those passions rather than, I think, the kind of more stable, go to law school, go into advertising, go into finance or something like that.
And that's just something you think you were born with.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
I do. I think that I've always, I think that I've always just had, it's funny because on the opposite, yes, I'm afraid to call myself a comedian, but also I am not somebody who does a lot of worst case scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
Like I kind of bet on things working out.
Yeah.
Like when I moved to LA, somebody asked me like, well, what was going to happen if that show didn't happen? I was like, honestly, you're the first person I never thought about it. I really didn't. I when I imagine what's going to happen, I imagine the best case.
Yeah,
and I head towards that.
Yeah.
And I've been lucky enough in a few moments. Shit hit the fan. But I've been lucky enough that enough times I've gotten the thing that I hoped would happen.
Yeah.
That I've been able to string together a life without the worst case scenario laying me too low.
I think there's an efficiency to that. And it's something I've talked about on this podcast before, that I've done lots and lots of therapy. And one of the things that you learn, you know, that you learn as you kind of learn the lingo and learn how it all works, you think, oh, I shouldn't compartmentalize. You know, like my life should be this sort of integrated, sort of free-flowing river of awareness. Then it's like, no, the compartmentalizing is great because you embark on a new adventure and what happens if it doesn't work out? No, fuck that. That goes in a box.
Right.
You know, and it's much more efficient to look at, well, you know, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. And somebody in my life used to always look at the worst case scenario and say, it helps me that in case that happens, I have prepared myself for it. And I was always like, that seems like a drag and B, kind of a waste of time.
A friend and I, we have this, we sometimes will rate people. And we'll rate them on two qualities that often get combined but are different.
Yeah.
Which is how anxious are they and how optimistic they are.
Mm-hmm.
And those get combined a lot. But if you actually think about the friends in your life, you'll realize, wait a second, they're extremely anxious and optimistic.
Yeah.
Right? And I think sometimes people get themselves into trouble when they're both very anxious and pessimistic. I don't think there's anything wrong with kind of going hard, trying for something, believing it will work out, but having in the back of your mind a voice saying, uh-oh, things might go the other way. And I think there are people that kind of don't expect great things to happen, but they're not super, they're pretty sanguine about it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I think it's that you'll stop yourself if you're both anxious and pessimistic.
Yeah,
I think that's
yeah.
sort of like the trap.
Right. Well, I think also too, and I don't know what to do with this, but I often think, especially, you know, in a podcast where I talk to people who have achieved something, it's why they're, here promoting things and being on podcasts, and they're interesting. And I always, there's times when I think like, well, you know, the world is mostly made up of people who aren't striving, and
That is the problem, right? There's a famous example of that, which is, you know, when the planes would come back from their bombing runs in World War II, only a certain segment of the planes would come back, and then they would look at the planes that come back and they'd say, well, where are the holes in those planes? And they say, oh, you've got to strengthen those areas. And so it was like, no. Those are the ones that came back. Strengthen everywhere else.
Yeah.
Because the ones that came back survived. Right. We don't need to strengthen those areas.
This is where you could take the bullets.
Right. And so, you know, if you're, if you've had success in this town, in entertainment, and in any field where a bunch of people, any field that something that a kid might say they want to do it when they grow up,
yeah.
You know, if you've had success in that kind of a field, like you've made a bombing run and you've made it back with bullet holes, but there are a lot of people that don't get to make it. It takes a crazy amount of luck.
Yeah.
And your experiences are not necessarily helpful to people that are experiencing different kinds of setbacks.
Yeah. Were you like a leader in high school? No.
I think I always wanted to be. I think, you know, you imagine, you know, you're watching right. West Wing or something and you imagine you will be. But what I think about now is, oh, of course, I was closeted. I'm gay. I don't know.
What?
Yeah.
No, oh, I know. Well, this, my research says that you're a real coxman with the ladies. Wikipedia.
Coxman, a coxman. There was a time when my Wikipedia only said, love it is gay. Which I was like, okay. It's not wrong. It's false.
It covers a lot of stuff.
Curious about the person that edited that in there. Sort of sitting in their home doing free work for this website, being like, I think people need to know this guy's seen penises that aren't his own. This guy, I think this guy knows a way.
Yeah.
A coxman of a different sort.
He's for the fellas.
For the fellas. A confirmed bachelor. But no, I think that I was depressed and I was closeted and I was afraid to be myself. And I think I spent a long time being that way. And really, there are these studies that come out that say, wow, like even in places as progressive as New York or Seattle, that there's still gay people still have higher rates of depression, and all kinds of members of the LGBT community still have all these different risks of self-harm. And it's like, moving to New York doesn't solve everything.
Yeah.
And you're dealing with thousands of years of built up cultural biases. And so, I've come out and I'm very comfortable, very happy, but it took me a really long time. It's not about the little bullying moments. It's not about the fear of coming out. Not for me, it wasn't those things. I think it is more the internalized, completely unacknowledged, like unexamined, like homophobia that you kind of, and homophobia, not just about being afraid to be gay, but the homophobia of being afraid to be feminine, to be emotionally and psychologically like open and willing to try things and willing to kind of not be what you thought a boy was supposed to be, mm-hmm. whatever that means.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I spent a really long time grappling with that. And I think it's like an ongoing project. Like I think even now I think about like, it's what I wear, how I present, how I'm talking to you now. Like, what version of my voice are you getting? Even in this sentence, it's getting gayer because I'm realizing I was doing my serious podcast voice. And it's like, well, I don't want to do that. I want to gay it up. I want to really fag it up here with my friend Annie.
Do it, man. Let's
do it, man.
Come on, man.
Nothing has ever, nothing, the most comforting words for a gay person are, just do it, man.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at tmobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Here you are, BPMs high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy. And your plants do too. Aw, I mean, just look at the little guy. Water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.
Can't you tell my love's a crow?
I have a gay son, and
gross.
I think I think that even with him, like part of his, I mean, I can't speak for him, but I think that they're like even in his sort of, you know, coming of age, and he was really kind of never closeted, at least not with his mother and me. But I think like there's also, in addition to figuring out being a man in the society, what a boy is and what a man is, it's like also like what gay is. I think, yeah. You know, it's like you got to figure out that out because, you know, my dad is also gay. I'm surrounded by him.
Skips a generation.
Yeah.
You know,
it really does. Cause I am 100% hetero, ladies. But I think it was, it was like, he's kind of 50s gay. Like, there's still, I think the closet haunts him in many ways.
Yeah, well, I also, so much of what it meant to be gay was to be gay in defiance of sometimes explicit laws.
Sure.
But also a ton of biases and rules for what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, rules about what could get you fired, what have you. And so much of gay culture was about defying that. So much of what a pride parade is was about defying that. And I do think, like, it is, we're still in it. I think that I was coming out, and I think even still today, though to a lesser extent, we're still in this kind of space between where there is a ton of acceptance.
Yeah.
A ton of acceptance. Yeah. And easier today than it was for me, easier for me than it was for anyone before. But the, like, legacy and assumptions and like kind of the cultural divot of so much homophobia is still there. And so I like being a gay kid today, like what a blessing when you look all the way back. But at the same time, you're now in this place where so much of what gay culture is and has been is a culture of defiance, but that doesn't necessarily speak to you because that's not your experience.
Right.
So how do you figure out what it means to be gay when so much of the culture that you're going to look to, because your parents probably aren't gay.
Mm-hmm.
They still have some questions about you, but most gay kids don't have a mincing sweet boy.
I'm just fancy, sir.
Yeah, sure.
I am merely fancy.
It's a beautiful blouse you're wearing, by the
way. Thank you very much.
But you have to figure out what it means for you, and it's still hard. It's just still hard.
Yeah. Well, it's, and we'll get to it later because you wrote the don't ask, don't tell speech, you know, and we'll get to that later, but it's as you said, we're dealing with thousands of years, and it seems like, oh, the world's really pretty cool now in comparison, but it's been 5 minutes.
I also think that's
Barack Obama said, I'm for civil unions. I'm not for gay marriage. And we all knew he's fine with gay marriage.
When I was a speechwriter, I remember when a Democrat saying, I'm for civil unions was an applause line.
Yeah,
because it was a implicit rejection of the efforts to ban all kinds of gay partnerships and the terrible homophobia on the right. And within a few years, when a Democrat said, we must have civil unions, applause, 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 applause starts getting quieter, applause starts getting quieter until it was sort of like a.
Yeah.
And then it was like, nope, it's time to be for marriage. It happened in like 4 years.
I do think, though, it sucks. But yeah, that process. And that's like, you know, people would get very impatient, and they get very impatient with their Democratic leaders.
Yeah.
Because they want things that are going to eventually get there. They want it to get there now. But the fact is, they're governing for everybody. And half the people don't want that. And yeah, it takes a while. You got to wear them down, you know? And that was like when he said, I'm more in favor of civil unions. People scream and yell, but it's like, yeah, but the guy's, it's coming. Just, he's got to say that or else their hair will set on fire and it'll be a distraction from a million other things.
And I do think that like there's an outside game and an inside game. You need people on the outside pushing for the right thing.
Yeah.
Not the right thing that's politically convenient, not the right thing that 51% of the country will get behind. You need people outside pushing on the right thing. You also need people inside, some of whom say, you know what? I'm not just going to build a policy platform that is a set of 55, 45, and 65, 35 issues.
Yeah.
I'm going to do a bunch of that. But you know what? On this one, this is too important to me. I know that voters aren't with me yet, but I'm going to do my job to persuade them. That's right. Part of what my job is. And I think you can see that at every level of government. But when you're the president or when you're running for president, when the stakes are so high, yeah. Especially now when the stakes are total,
I think that
your goal, right, is to do the most good. If you view your path to winning as requiring you to focus on issues A, B, C, D, E, F, and G and not issue K,
yeah.
That might be something that's important. It might even be something you work towards if you win, but not something that's going to be persuasive. Sometimes politics is politics. And you're going to say, you know what? This may make some people upset. And by the way, I agree with them. But for right now, I don't want to talk about that issue.
Yeah.
And depending on the issue, depending on the day, depending on the campaign, that might be something you understand or that might be something you think is kind of ugly in politics at its worst. And I don't know, maybe both things are true.
Yeah, yeah. No, and as I just said what I said, like I know how frustrating incrementalism can be, but it is kind of like it's a fact of life, not just in politics, but, you know, when you think about just, you know, my development as a human being, like
sure.
It's incremental. And it isn't to say, too, that people should not be pushed and pushed and pushed. And thank God for the people that really, really push.
Politics is in so many ways so completely broken. And especially when one side has this, you know, there is this, when one side says, if we lose the game, we're burning down the stadium. It's hard to play.
Yes,
it's
exactly,
hard to play.
Exactly.
But despite all these, despite all the ways in which the system feels completely broken, there's still persuasion. It still can work, right?
Yeah.
Like you look at what's happening just in response to Roe being overturned. There was a special election in Alabama where a seat just got flipped. Why?
Yeah.
Well, because voters in Alabama said, you know what? We didn't like that our Supreme Court ruled in a way that might make it impossible for me to have a child through IVF. You've seen that through special elections all across the country.
Yep.
Where people, even in very red places, are saying, you know what? I know that for years polling on this might not have made this clear, and I know that this is a controversial issue, and I know that there are people in my life that feel differently, but I'm going to go vote because I believe, even if I personally, and a lot of people do, have concerns about or moral questions and discomforts with abortion, because that is what a lot of people feel, I'm going to get in my car and I'm going to drive across town and I'm going to vote in the special election
yeah.
because I want abortion to be protected.
Yeah. And because that engages people where, you know, trade does not, you
right.
know, they don't even, people don't even know, you know,
yeah.
They don't even know.
It affects
them. And they have their own lives, you know, their lives are busy. But if they say IVF, what? Fuck that. That's crazy.
You know,
got to put an end to this, you know? And it was like, didn't Trump won that district by 20 or something?
Something like that, yeah.
Something like that. So, you know, thank God. That's all I can say. Thank God. Well, let's get back to you.
Oh,
enough
finally.
Enough about the world.
Oh.
You went to college at Williams College. Where is that?
It's in Northwest Massachusetts.
In Northwest Massachusetts. And why there?
I don't know.
Okay.
I think I made a weird decision.
We can move on.
I think I made a weird decision. I think I made a weird decision. I was a closeted, nerdy, 5'7" gay kid who went to a sports college in rural Massachusetts.
Oh, God,
I don't think
so
I was.
Hot.
I don't think I was
so hot.
I don't think I was making pristine decisions. But I ended up loving it. But why did I go there? I don't know.
I like sports college.
So, yeah, what, like, why am I living with lacrosse players? What is this choice that I've made? I could have gone anywhere.
We don't sleep in beds. We sleep in footlockers full of footballs.
That's right.
Is it like a liberal arts college?
Yes, it's a really great liberal arts college. It's a great math program. But it's a great school. Uh-huh. And I loved Williams.
And you studied math.
I did.
Wow.
Yeah.
But you never decided of the triumvirate of interests.
Here was the problem, which we have math, politics, and comedy. The problem for me, so there was a kid I went to school with. He actually majored in physics and became, he did become a physicist. And he could do a Rubik's Cube behind his back.
Oh, my God.
And I just remember thinking,
how the fuck he would picture it?
He would do it, look once, and do it again.
Oh, wow.
And I remember when I saw that, I thought, John, you are ambitious. You are not good enough at math to get the life you want out of math. You may make the funniest PowerPoint at the senior seminar presentations, which I did. But no, you're not gonna knock anybody's socks off with your math skills. In fact, I did a presentation on statistics once, and the joke at that event was that I had bound and gagged the statistics professor so that it couldn't be properly evaluated because he missed it. Because nobody believed that they were like, we need a stats guy here. We don't have one. And we're pretty suspicious of you. It's funny. It was a funny presentation, but we don't know about this math. But I loved math. And I ended up, after I graduated, writing a paper with my professor and publishing a math article, like really kind of pursuing it. And I just realized that as much as I enjoyed it, it wasn't going to be the fulfilling career I wanted. So I still love like hard math problems. I love thinking about math. It's sort of a hobby, mm-hmm. but it does not. It was never going to be the full-time career, I don't think.
It's pretty much the only difference between you and me is the math thing.
Because you're always saying like, the only thing that I hate more than not having a cock to suck is math.
As a Long Island Jewish guy, I really, if it weren't for cocks, I'd be mad at math still. Oh, God, what have we done?
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
I'm Phoebe Judge, host of the podcast This Is Love, stories about love and all of the surprising forms it can take. Like a man who finds a baby on a subway platform, a woman who spends most of her time alone until a fox starts coming around. And in one of my favorite episodes, we meet a man who forgot his wife and had to get to know her and fall in love all over again. Listen to new episodes of This Is Love wherever you get your podcasts.
Can't you tell my love's a crow?
Well, now it says that you gave the speech.
When I graduated.
The graduation speech.
Yes.
Was the rest of the class in on that?
Ran for it. It was an elective office. Ran for class speaker. I had this idea when it was such a Tracy Flick thing, but like I was so unpopular when I graduated from high school. And when I got into college, I was like, you know what? You're gonna make friends here.
Yeah.
Make friends here.
Whether they want to or not.
Whether they want to, you're gonna, the football guys are gonna think you're okay, and they're gonna find some nerds, and you're gonna make them your friends. Fucking like you. But I decided that when I was a senior, I was like, you know what? I'm gonna run for class speaker. That is a fucking popularity contest. I wanna win a popularity contest.
I'll
show those kids from Syosset. And so I was like, I'm gonna run for this thing, and I'm gonna run for class speaker. And I did, and it ended up becoming, it was like a real campaign. I remember I was running against a football player, and then it became like the jocks versus the non-jocks, and there was like, oh, who's the female, the field hockey team gonna vote for?
Yeah.
But I won. But I won that race. It was a very big moment for me.
Nerds rule.
And hey, Nerds Rule. We don't go back and watch those Revenge of the Nerds movies because we won't like what we find. But in theory, if we close our eyes and don't picture anything,
right? In theory, empowering.
Yes, we want
as
the nerds.
As long as you don't watch them,
simply do not watch them. It's very important that you don't watch them, but
just believe
in the idea of them. don't turn them on.
Oh dear.
But and I spoke at that graduation and I got some laughs and I was like, you know what? I want to give this.
You like that?
I liked it. Yeah. I liked it. And I thought I can do this. And so I moved to New York and I was a temp paralegal, mm-hmm. filling out forms at asbestos law firms.
Oh boy.
Helping people get their money.
Woo, party.
Yeah, it was a blast. It was just a windowless room and there was an inbox and an outbox and real paralegals all day would fill up the inbox and our goal was to get the process that paperwork into the outbox fast enough before they could bring us another stack so that we could chill.
Wow.
Day after day. And it was maddening because we have absolutely no insight into some days, three or four pop in, it's pretty chill, you're getting paid to talk about movies. And then some days, so many people are filing asbestos claims and we have no idea when they're gonna happen. It was maddening. And the room was truly windowless.
Wow.
Truly windowless room, door opens, files come in, door closes. Door opens, files go out, door closes. And we just did that day after day after day. But at night, I would do open mics, or I would fill out law school applications just to keep my...
Stop evildoers.
Right? Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. For sure. You know, get my underwear on and kill them with kindness.
At what point did you come out, if I may ask?
I started coming out right when I got to college. Okay. Right before, maybe like that very end of high school.
Yeah. So by the time you graduated...
Yeah, I'm out and
you
about.
You were fully out.
Yeah, for sure.
And was it well received at home?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was. It was... It was a very... I think that it was, everyone was very supportive of me. I think it took a beat for them to understand how it could be true mm-hmm. because in fairness to them, they were like, have you ever had a girlfriend? No. Have you ever had a boyfriend? No. Interesting. So it was a bit more like, how do you know, you fucking virgin? You know, that kind of a thing. They didn't say it exactly.
You should do a Pepsi challenge. Blind test.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's like, I think that's either R.C. Cola or I think it's a penis. Is that a?
I do not like this. That's a vagina.
Is that a tab?
Oh, ick. No, thank you.
Tab?
No, it's a vagina.
It's a vagina.
Oh, yeah, it's fun. I mean, it is fun. Like, parents that, it's funny to, like, not, to, like, be like, are you sure?
Well, just, like, they're from it. It was really just, like, I think they hadn't thought about it. But it was all, they were very supportive. All my friends were supportive. It was really, I got a lot of the, of course you were.
Right.
Come on, you fruitcake. Who are you kidding? Who are you kidding?
At one point when
we've seen you walk.
When my son was... my son and his boyfriend had been together for like 6 or 7 years. They started dating when they were like 16. And at one point, my daughter, who's 5 years younger than him, I guess my son was hanging out with some girl, had a friend that was a girl. And my daughter at dinner said, she said, like, I think Will has a girlfriend. And Will just like, he rolled his eyes and he's like, yeah, surprise. Like, just the gayest answer you could
but it's
possibly
so,
have.
It's
surprise.
How nice to be to be able to date when you're that age.
Yeah.
I do think like so many people my age.
It's LA. And,
but they just, you pay for not having had that time for so long. And I do think that a lot of like gay people end up with this sort of prolonged adolescence in part because they just never got to have that formative experience.
Absolutely. I mean, when I, like my son's prom pictures, to show them to people at work and to the gay members of the Conan staff.
You can show the straight people too. They might want to see. You know, just
gay. I was terribly ashamed.
Their eyes
bleed. Like, no, he went to prom with a boy. I'd show him around, I would show him to everybody, but But I could tell, like, you know, like these 58-year-old gay men are like, oh, that's so sweet. But you could also, it's like, you know, like also a punch in the gut, you know, kind of a little, well, just a little jab, you know, like, damn it. I never had this.
I played Mario 64 during my prom.
Did you?
I did.
Oh, wow.
So my date was Luigi.
Oh. But you weren't at the prom, right?
No.
Okay, because I was going to say that would be distracting.
I was at home with Luigi. Me and Luigi.
That's a me.
Yeah. Oh, what do you mean your brother's here?
Oh, that's a threesome.
Oh. And go to, that's not the right pipe, Mario.
Sorry.
I don't know why I came and brought up vulgar energy today.
Have you noticed that? I love it. It's good. We're, you know, it's we're getting towards dinner time and it's getting dirty. So how does the political thing, you started volunteering for Kerry, right?
I was doing this temp paralegaling. I was doing these open mics and
any real set goal in mind or just kind of kicking around seeing what happens?
Just seeing what happens. Yeah. I didn't have a goal. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was also applying to law school. I was all over the place. I didn't really know what I wanted to
do. And are you finding a good tribe of people to hang with or is it still a little isolated?
It's isolated. Yeah. I lived with one of my best friends. But he got a finance job. So he's gone, right? He's one of those, when you get those finance jobs out of college, you're working 17, 18, school, insane hours.
Yeah.
So I'm really kind of by myself in New York. And I don't really have much time because I'm working all day, then I'm doing law school applications, and then I'm going to whatever open mic I can find on a website.
Yeah.
But I ended up volunteering for the Kerry campaign, and that led to a very junior job in Washington working for a senator. And of course I took it. I had nothing keeping me. I was just sort of, I was like, sure, that's a job. I'll do it. Let me try it.
Do they just take notice of you around the Kerry campaign headquarters?
So by the time I got to DC, a bunch of people had been kind of shipped off to various regional offices. Mm-hmm. So the headquarters was getting a bit quiet and they needed some help drafting very simple, inartful statements. Like there's a storm or there's an event where you just need a paragraph that says something like, Senator Kerry wishes this team from Albuquerque a congratulations on their successful triumph at whatever, or our thoughts are with the people of New Orleans after Hurricane Ivan, or something like that. And I had ended up doing a few of those. And so when...
And they were hilarious.
And they were... My hurricane stuff. Oh, boy.
It slayed
them. Oh, boy. Category hilarious. Terrible. So the person I had interned for, volunteered for, intern, volunteer, same.
Yeah.
It's funny, at that time, internships were unpaid, obviously volunteers were unpaid. If you were like a senior citizen, you were a volunteer, but if you were like under 25, they'd let you call yourself an intern.
Right, right.
So it felt more professional.
Yeah,
but I was a volunteer.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I was doing.
Right.
But so the person I had volunteered for got a job after the campaign ended and remembered me and said, hey, we're going to hire one person. Do you want to come be this very junior press assistant in this Senate office? And I jumped at it. I didn't know anything about the senator, didn't know anything about working in the Senate. I really just knew nothing.
And who was the senator?
It was John Corzine.
Okay.
Who was a former Goldman Sachs executive, then is currently best known for running, I think, a private equity fund or a hedge fund that misplaced $1 billion.
Oops.
And they were like, where did it go, man? He's like, honestly, I don't know. It's truly crazy. Wow. I am embarrassed.
I remember the name, but I don't remember. Was he New York, New Jersey?
New Jersey.
New Jersey. Yeah, okay.
So I ended up working for him, and I wrote jokes for some of his speeches.
Yeah.
And that led to somebody hearing word that there was somebody who could write jokes. So that's how I ended up writing some jokes for Hillary Clinton. And then when they were hiring a junior speechwriter, they remembered. And I threw my hat in for that. And that's how I became a junior speechwriter for Hillary Clinton.
Uh-huh.
And that was where
for
I was.
For her Senate campaign.
For her Senate office.
Yeah,
Senate
yeah.
office.
Senate yeah, office. Yeah. Okay, wow.
Yeah. So I kind of, so I went from volunteering on the Kerry campaign to this junior press job to this junior speechwriting job.
Wow. And are you kind of like surprised that your life has taken this turn when you were applying to law school or?
I was so in over my head.
Yeah.
So completely, it's, if I had been any more over my head, dead person wouldn't have made it. If I had been any less over my head, I would have been able to see how crazy what was happening was and have been unable to function.
Wow.
I was the perfect amount of in over my head because all I could do is get up super early, go there, pretend I knew how to write speeches and hope nobody noticed.
Totally
over and over
that.
And over again. I'm like 22, 23. I think that like, I didn't know this at the time, but the fact that they hired me was sort of almost like an admission of failure, that they weren't going to find anybody with any kind of qualifications or that they thought could do a good
really?
Job. They had gone through, if they tried a few people, it hadn't been working. They're like, well, let's just try some junior person and we'll have somebody more senior over. So let's try something.
Yeah.
So I'm like going to the Senate building. I'm buying a giant iced coffee and a giant chocolate chip cookie every morning, just sort of straight to the dome.
Yeah,
and then just like, I don't know, but I hope this works. I hope she says this stuff and nobody gets in trouble. Here we go.
Sorry, New York State.
Yeah.
You know.
Good evening, Utica.
Do they give you guidance?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, there's bullet points you got to hit, and then you just do connective tissue, right?
Yeah, it basically writes itself, but the... But so, no, like, there are really very serious policy people around. There's communications people.
Right.
They're all providing
you're
input.
You're not deciding about, like,
no.
her vote on trade and stuff?
No, yeah, last yeah. to know.
Yeah.
No, so I'm just turning. But the thing about it, when you're for a Senate office, so she's a very prominent person, obviously, but she's also a working senator. And so a lot of it is the Boy Scouts are coming to town, or you're speaking to the Asian and Pacific Islanders Convention, or there's the Suffolk County Realtors are having their convention, and they're just sort of writing these kind of workmanlike speeches that are just kind of meant to hit some key bullets, some policies. And that was sort of how I learned. I learned doing those less important speeches, but it really did take me, years. I really like... And it wasn't until there was another speechwriter came on board when she was running for president named Sarah Hurwitz, who was a much more seasoned speechwriter. And it was finally, and there were other speechwriters who were around who were great, but it wasn't until I had a truly experienced speechwriter working with me day by day that I was like, oh,
this is how you do it. I see.
What have I been doing? How am I not fired? It's crazy.
I told the Suffolk County Realtors to fuck off.
And by the way, I don't. This is not the version of the story I would have told for many years.
Yeah.
It took me years to look back on this and be like, what the fuck were you doing there? and I was like mad at myself. Like, what? Of course you were fucking this up.
Oh, yeah.
This is crazy. This is crazy. You're a 23-year-old with a liberal arts degree. What are you doing here?
1993, the reason I say I understand this, early days of the Conan show, it's the same thing. If I had been more over my head, I would have died. But I had to be somewhat unaware of what dangerous waters we were navigating. You
of
know?
Course.
And looking back on those old shows, like which I can't do, we were terrible. We were awful. And people are like, I love the old days. Like, well, you go right ahead and love them because I think they're awful.
But I do think there is a point where, of course, you don't know how bad you are. You're bad.
Yeah.
You got to get better
right.
to learn what good is.
Right, exactly.
I do think also part of it's true in any kind of creative field, but it's certainly true in comedy writing. It's true in speech writing. One thing you have to learn is how hard it is.
Yeah.
And I do think that when you're first starting out, you have the kind of the innocence of believing that it's like not as hard as you. It's just you have your ideas and you write them down and they're good and you're done. You know, it's like
I also
like even if you've ever been in a right for anyone who's ever been in a writer's room, the first thing you learn in being a writer's room is like, oh, wow, this is a fucking grind.
Yeah.
Like you sit here for days trying to figure out what this story is going to be. Like breaking a story when you first, you know, what does that mean exactly? Why is it called that?
Right.
It's called that because you sit there, you shut up, and we're going to break this story.
Yeah.
And it's going to take days.
Yeah.
We're going to have to break it.
Like it's a slow moving horse.
Right.
A horse that moves at a glacial pace.
Yes.
You have to break it. Oh, it's bucking. It's not moving. It looks as if it's not moving.
And it smells fear on you. It will buck you.
Yes.
Yeah. Because you got the fear on you.
Well, now, I mean, then you go on to work in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a different thing altogether. And you're writing, you know, this isn't the realtors. This
no.
isn't the Boy Scouts.
So I spent 3 years learning how to be a speechwriter under Senator Hillary Clinton. And then after her presidential campaign, after she loses to then Senator Barack Obama, I go back to the Senate office and sort of not really sure what's going to happen, what I'm going to do next. And then the Obama team, which Jon Favreau was leading, I'm not sure if I heard from him directly yet, but basically the Obama White House was going to hire one more speechwriter. And I sort of threw my hat in the ring. And the way they hired is they had a blind speech test. They had a bunch of us write speeches, write the same speech, almost like a college final exam.
Right.
Here's the topic. Here are the facts. Here's the issue. Here's what we want to convey. Write a speech. And so a bunch of people wrote that speech, and mine was one that got plucked out, in part because I think I'd had a unique kind of training.
Yeah.
Because I was in a Senate office, and then I was on the longest Democratic primary that had been in many, many years. Mm-hmm. And so that was incredible training for being a presidential speechwriter.
Very functional training.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so then I went to work at the White House as a speechwriter. And that was, I think, the first job I'd ever had where it was hard and it was nerve wracking and I was anxious, and obviously the stakes felt so much higher, and you all of a sudden you're realizing like, oh, this is for the president. And then you kind of give yourself the yips a little bit because you kind of try to overwrite because now you think you're doing the Federalist Papers every time you open up the computer, and you got to get over that. But ultimately I felt like, you know what? I'm here. I learned a lot about speechwriting to put myself in a position to do this, and was able to work on everything from like economic policy speeches and science speeches and finance speeches to sort of the comedy stuff that the president gets to do.
Yeah, yeah. And is there a favorite that really stands out?
No. For me, it's more, I think you have like moments that you remember.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's like similar to any kind of writing where I'm sure you don't have a favorite episode, but you have a ton of favorite moments.
Yeah.
Specific moments or things like elements that you thought, like nothing is ever perfect. There's always things you'd want to do better.
Yeah.
But there was a speech on the serious front. There was a speech President Obama gave about healthcare right up in the run up to the passage of Obamacare. He was in Ohio, I want to say Strongville, Ohio. And he was talking about why he had come to Ohio, and he'd come there in part because a woman named Natoma Canfield had I believe written a letter about a medical hardship she'd experienced that Obamacare would ultimately have made more affordable. And she wasn't able to go because of her health condition, I believe. I may get the facts a little bit wrong. But he gave this speech and he said, I'm here because we need to do this, and I'm here because we need to do that, and I'm here because we can insure this many people, and I'm here because this many people haven't been able to afford insulin, and I'm here because of Natoma. I felt really proud of that. I remember that, like that feeling of like in the room. Like,
yeah.
Like, oh, that was, I like provided something that like, I'd provided my comparative advantage, right? I did the thing that I could do and did it well.
And also put a ball right in his particular strike zone.
Yes. And that was a great speech. And there were speeches I loved writing about space and science. And President Obama spoke at the National Academy of Sciences, and it was about every policy issue under the sun. It was about energy. It was about space and NASA. It was about investments in research and development. It was about a whole range of things. And I really liked kind of putting that, like framing that in a big way and trying to write something beautiful about like the power of science. And and then there were a bunch of different, I don't really now at this point remember whose jokes were whose. They're just it's gone probably the moment it was done. Yeah. But I loved working on the Correspondents' Dinner speeches.
Yeah,
and I feel really proud of those
because
I feel like even now people are like, you know what, when Obama went to the Correspondents' Dinner year after year, he really brought it. And I feel like
he can sell a joke. He's
the
real.
Best.
Yeah, he
the
can
best.
Really sell a joke. Is he funny?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
He has that dry, that wry sense of humor. And he would do, like we would always have a mix of jokes. There would be the kind of, I think we always found that the best mix of jokes, a bunch of us would write we were a bit unusual in that, like, there were people inside the White House that were writing a bunch of the jokes, plus getting a ton of jokes from outside. I think traditionally a speechwriter would just gather a ton of material and shape it, but we were more like, we did a little more like player managers. You know, we would write a bunch of material, and we, David Axelrod, President Obama's longtime advisor, is a brilliant person. He's also very funny, and he would write these great avuncular kind of political jokes. And we, my platonic ideal of a political joke is pushing the podium in over and you all go fuck yourselves. Like that to me, that's funny.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So we would always, I always feel like the, and then Jon Favreau, who's the head speechwriter, was really great at figuring out the tone and the balance and like punching up the jokes and figuring out exactly how to get it in Obama's voice. But I always felt like the best balance at those dinners. And by the way, tons of people submitted incredible material that made it possible. But that, like, a balance between the acts of avuncular style and the, like, my kind of, like, you all a bunch of fucking pieces of shit in here.
Right, right.
Like, which is the energy I would always bring to it. And if you get the balance right, that's how you know you kind of hit the right tone.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because, again, it's got to be funny, but it also has to be functional. And it has to, like, it's a, such a challenge because it, you know, you don't want to make more trouble for yourself. You know what I mean? You don't want to, you don't want him to say jokes that then, you know, just inspire stupidity. Well, you but, know, it's going to anyway, you know.
I think a lot of politicians claim they want humor in their speeches because they know that it's a value.
Yeah.
But then in any one speech, is it worth making a truly funny joke?
Right.
Is it worth the risk?
Right.
Because who wants
and is
to-
that really what you want?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But- And so there's sort of like two risks, right, with a joke for a politician. One is that it will be it'll be controversial or be seen as offensive or negative or not the right tone. The other is it just bombs.
Yeah.
And just does poorly. And we know that a bad joke, like a true terrible joke, like a comedian bombing, whatever, like we know it just feels bad. It's worse than just boring, right?
Mm-hmm.
A bad drama is boring.
Mm-hmm.
But when a joke bombs, it hurts in your chest. And that's especially bad for a politician because the whole point of a politician being there is to try to connect in some way, to relate, to prove that they understand what you're going through, that you're that kind of on the same page. And then you tell a joke that bombs and it's like, whoa, we are not the same. We do not share a sense of the absurd. We do not share a sense of what's funny. You are nothing to me.
Yeah.
Get out of here.
Yeah.
So it is a little bit, so that's why it is high risk. So, you know, those joke speeches, you just, that's the purpose of them. But a lot of times, I remember President Obama would be like, I want more jokes at the top of some of my other speeches because they really do stick with people.
Yeah.
But it's hard to find what that tone is. It's hard to like,
especially when your political jokes are, fuck you.
Well, right.
You
know? Yeah. No, that there was one that we did. There was, he was doing a speech on immigration and the border. Things never change, but
I'm laughing already.
But it was at the time where we were negotiating over a bipartisan immigration deal, and the Republicans kept moving the goalposts because we would say, we will do bipartisan immigration reform. We will do the border enforcement you want. You want border enforcement, you'll get border enforcement. We will do whatever you want. And every time you concede, it'd say, we'll do more border agents. We'll do more money for border security. We'll do more inspections, whatever you want. Every time they say they want more, they want more.
Yeah, yeah.
And so President Obama went to Texas and he gave this speech about the importance of actually passing something. And he said, I've already given Republicans everything they want on the border. It's never enough. Next thing you know, they're going to want a moat. And they're going to want to put alligators in the moat.
Oh my God.
And it went everywhere.
Yeah,
it went everywhere. And it was exactly what a joke can do in politics when it's doing what it's supposed to do, which is it was an on-message point, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like Republicans are moving the goalposts on the border and they're being unreasonable.
Yeah.
It was funny and light, you know?
Yeah.
It wasn't glib about the seriousness of the issue in any way that was, I think, offensive to anybody.
It was glib about their unseriousness.
Yes. It had the right target. And because a joke that works, people like it. It was on a lot of news broadcasts. It made the rounds in a way that a serious version of that speech never would have.
Right. And then didn't Trump actually say something about that? Like put alligators in a moat?
You know, here's the thing. Sure. Yes. I bet yes.
I think he
probably did.
I think he did.
Yeah. Trump is like, you know, there's that book where there's that it has every combination of letters. So if you can look up anything and it's in the book, it's that's Trump's repertoire.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, he probably said there should be alligators
down
there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, now you come to Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
You start writing for TV.
Mm-hmm.
What was the first one? Was it 1600?
It was. So it was,
yeah, yeah.
So I, again, now it's like I was finally, as I said, I was like, oh, I'm, you know what? Like, I can do this. I feel good about myself. I think I was fucking things up left and right. We always are. But I was, I had like learned the ropes, right? And now I'm feeling kind of, not comfortable exactly, but.
Comfortable to take what you learned and turn it into a TV show.
Well, more of that, I think that I felt like I belonged to the club. And so I had to leave because I shouldn't belong to a club that would have me as a member.
I see.
And so I'm all of a sudden,
did
I'm like,
you also
no.
feel like you get stuck
yes.
in it. Yeah, yeah.
And I do think that now looking back, and it was like, no, of course you should have stayed longer. It was a once in a lifetime opportunity, but you were so kind of not insecure a little bit, anxious a little bit that, oh, like I need to do something else. I need to do something else. And I'd always had this pull of wanting to do something in comedy. And the longer I was, in, you know, when I was first in politics, like, you know, you're, what do you, when you, you, I was thinking about the West Wing and like, you know, kind of, you imagine yourself doing politics. And now when I was thinking about like, what do I imagine myself doing? It was the West Wing. It was,
yeah, yeah.
but then it became like, oh, now I'm here.
Yeah.
Now I'm doing it. And now I'm like, I want to do stand up. Like that, like the little fantasy change.
Right.
And so I decided, you know what? Like again, like not pristine decision making. I think I just turned 29 and had this realization that if I don't leave soon, I've never been a young stand-up.
Yeah.
I was about to turn 30 and I felt like, well, I want to do this in my 20s. I want to do this at the beginning. I want to start doing this. And so
your comedy biological clock.
Right, which is nonsense and not any way a person should think about it. But
and not anything anyone really ever.
No,
it's, no one else in the world has ever put.
I'm like, telling
if
you,
you're not on a stand-up stage by 30, fuck you.
Just pure mental nonsense that I did not test on another human being. Just, you know, sometimes you're thinking something, you can think it for years.
Absolutely.
If you said it out loud to one person, it would fall apart.
Yes.
It's a hothouse flower, this idea.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, can't be exposed to elements.
Right, right.
But so I have this dumb reason, but anyway, it drove me. And I said, you know what? I want to move to LA. I want to do stand up. How am I going to do that? I've been doing these low-level government jobs. I can't move to LA. So I ended up, because I had gotten some notoriety, I guess, for doing the jokes for President Obama, there are people that are like, well, he should write a comedy. Let's do a script. And so I started working on a pilot, and I didn't know
Did you get an agent first?
I got an agent.
Yeah.
That I had met when they had come to the correspondence dinner.
Of course.
I really worked this thing.
Right, right.
And they got me into a blind script deal, a term I was learned about. By the way, that's the second ableist use of the word blind today.
Yeah.
Blind speech test, blind script deal.
Yeah.
Something to think about.
Yep.
Got to hold myself accountable.
Totally trashing your deaf grandparents, too.
Yeah, yeah. But he won't hear it. Because he died 40 years ago.
Right, I know. But he could be a ghost in this room reading your lips right now.
I wonder if deaf ghosts can hear.
What a question.
Wow.
Never thought about it.
Wow.
Well,
because they probably, it's like, hey, this being dead's not bad. At least I can hear.
That's what you people sounded like? This sucks. What were we talking about?
I don't know.
I moved to LA. I think I'm going to do stand-up. I think I'm going to learn how to write a pilot. But then Josh Gad has this idea about a ne'er-do-well first son.
Uh-huh.
And he's like looking for somebody to help him write it. We meet. We work on it together with Jason Weiner, a TV director. And I'm moved to LA. And within days, weeks, I'm working on something that is going to be on television.
Wow.
And which, again, I'm back to where I was at 22, 23, completely and totally in over my head. And look, I know what an asshole I am. I know it. I know. Like, fuck me.
If anyone,
I know.
Just take that away from this podcast. Yeah.
Dancing between the raindrops. I'm very lucky.
Yeah.
I know, but I'm just telling you what happened.
I understand.
I know you understand.
Not, yeah, you didn't, you know.
I know you understand.
I mean, I'm sure that you stepped on plenty of throats on your way up the ladder. But you just dealt you played the hand that you shuffled the deck and got.
That's exactly right. But so we work on this pilot together. I panic several times, stop replying to email for days at a time because I don't know what I am doing.
Yeah.
I don't know what I am doing. I downloaded the script writing software to write this thing that is going to be on the National Broadcasting Company. Yeah. And it's like, what is anyone going to intervene and stop this? This is insane. But it happens. Yeah. And wouldn't you know it? Only lasted one season. But I learned an incredible lesson. We wrote 1600 Pen, cult classic. That's what I say.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And we all know our characters from 1600 Pen. Right? Who's your favorite character from 1600 Pen?
The president.
Oh, you like the president.
Oh, the president.
People love the
so
president.
Great.
Any others?
The vice president?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
so good.
For sure. For sure.
The, I never saw that.
I never missed it. You missed it.
Now, what's it like to write? Do you find that is writing for fake White House better than writing for real White House?
So the thing about writing a speech is a story.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an argument, really. Mm-hmm. And you can use anecdotes, and you can use examples, and you can use data, and you can use facts, and you can use the speaker's experience. You can use history, whatever you want. But you're ultimately just making an argument, and it's A, B, C, D, E, F, G. What I found really challenging, and I didn't even understand how much of a skill it was, is when you're working in when you're writing a television show, you're so far from writing it down. You start so far away from dialogue, from just, mm-hmm. you start with, it's a much more collaborative, and I do think technically challenging thing to do. Like that, and maybe part of it is because I had a lot more experience by the time I left speechwriting. I had no idea. I don't think anybody, I was a full fucking novice. I had no idea what went into making a TV show. And so like, it was so hard, and I learned so much. Mike Royce, who was a long time Raymond writer, he came on and he basically, you know, it was like, he was the dad and I was the fun uncle.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And he kind of really made sure we kind of kept this thing on the rails. Yeah. And without him, it would have fallen apart.
They usually hire, for the newer people, usually hire like a grown-up to show you the ropes.
Absolutely. And that is what he was. And he was excellent. And I learned a ton from him. But I loved, and I think what I am still far better at is like a funny joke, a funny line. I don't think I have the aptitude for like, the structure.
Yeah.
That was really hard for me. It's still hard for me.
Yeah.
Like, I just want to write really funny jokes and I want to write really funny conversations.
Right.
Like, that's the part I want to do.
But
that's,
is.
Of course, what everybody wants
right.
to do.
The
hard part.
That's the juice,
is,
you know. Yeah.
That's the hard part.
Right. You know, once again, I want to say you got a book coming.
Mm-hmm.
Do you plan, do you see yourself writing lots and lots of books coming out?
If I ever write another book. You play this for me. If anyone comes over to you, if anyone tells you that I'm thinking about working on another fucking book, you tell them that you play this. And I said, no. No books.
No books.
No books is a stupid medium. It's stupid.
It's dead.
We've been working on this thing for a year. A year of writing this book. I'm really happy with it.
Yeah.
we actually got the galleys of the book today. It's called Democracy or Else. And what I'm proud of is, so it's called How to Save Democracy in 10 Easy Steps. It's sarcastic.
Right.
You know,
it's harder. Comedy. Yeah, we know it's harder than that.
Yeah. They're not easy steps.
Right.
And it's actually a lot more steps if you really think about it.
Right.
But that's part of the fun of the book.
Right.
But what I'm really proud of is, so it's me and Jon Favreau and Tommy Vietor, my Pod Save America co-hosts, and Josh Holloway wrote it with us, and he writes the monologue with Jimmy Kimmel. Really mm-hmm. funny guy. But what I'm really proud of is I think that there's a lot of really funny political comedy, obviously. And I think there's a lot of people thinking about earnestly how to keep people invested in democracy at a time when there are so many forces trying to make people cynical, make people turn away, make people not pay attention. And what I feel really proud of is we kind of put those things together because this is an earnest book, but we were able to do it in a way that I saw it today. I was like, wow, I cannot believe we made this joke in this thing.
Yeah.
We're going to get in trouble.
Really?
I can't wait.
Wow.
I don't know what it's going to be.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what's going to get us in trouble.
Right.
But I think that especially in the Trump era, is not being cynical and funny is hard, but being earnest and optimistic and hopeful mm-hmm. and funny is even harder. And that's what we're trying for.
I've never, on the Conan show, we were sort of, if we were political, we were silly political.
Yeah.
And just because, and it wasn't, because the Daily Show came out and this, it was like a whole new thing, to be that pointedly political, but also funny and engaging and entertaining. And I can only speak for myself, but I feel like the whole show sort of felt like, we don't know how to do that. And we're not interested in that really. And I find, I'll write wisecracks on social media and stuff, but to really make political humor, I don't know how to make that funny. Because I get so,
yeah.
I get worked up and bummed out. And,
I've heard you say a version of that. I've heard Conan say a version of that. And I think it is true in the sense that obviously you're not doing partisan policy and political
right,
coverage.
Right.
But I do think being silly and joyful and open, and embracing of weirdness in the way that show did is an act of politics. It is. It is everything is political.
Yeah.
And that is I do think that is a kind of politics.
I see what you're saying.
I would say, you look at Leno and then you look at Conan, both shows that would say, we don't do politics.
Yeah.
But I would say Conan has a political point of view that I admire, your show had a political point of view I admire, in a way that I think other shows that would say they are not political, I don't.
Yeah.
And that you can do that while never talking about the latest State of the Union.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason I think that so many people still talk about how much they love that show, even though it wasn't political, because it does have a politics. It did have an impact on people who all together have a worldview,
Yes. Well, and there was real the people had politics.
Of course.
But that it just didn't really come out on the show because, there was and I think it also, too, is because we predated, we got on the air before anyone was kind of doing that. And it would have felt like copycat if we had tried to sort of emulate something else. And I see what you're saying, and it's nice to hear. And I guess, we were sort of as subversive as two white men in suits, doing bits with puppets and.
I don't know. I'm thinking about it. It's what does it mean? It's apolitical, but it is just by saying this is possible on television, is defying a convention and saying, hey, these rules don't apply.
Right.
And a bunch of young people watching a show where a bunch of other people are saying, look at these rules. You didn't even need to follow any of them.
Yeah.
That isn't conservative.
Right.
You may
right.
not be political, but it's not conservative.
I was just thinking, absurdity is more liberal.
Yeah. I mean,
it's more liberal. If you're into absurdity, I don't think you're thinking, we should close the borders.
Right.
I'm saying
I don't think the Venn diagram of people who like masturbating
canes.
Bear
yes.
and people who think right and people who like Trump. I don't think that Venn diagram
no,
has
I don't
a
think
big
they
overlap.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that says something, doesn't it?
I think okay.
Maybe
all right.
maybe more political than you'd want to admit.
Right, exactly. I think we did way more than the Daily Show ever did in terms of contributing
and I'm always
this
saying
country.
That. Sure, anybody can say what
right.
they think, but to feel it.
Right.
You know?
Right. right. Go ahead and preach to the choir. We're writing their music.
Jesus. God damn it.
That's pretty good, right?
That was good.
I wish you were still writing speeches.
That was good. Look at that. Still got it, huh? Still got it. Huh?
Well, okay.
Smartest closeted gay guy in the business. I've always said that about Andy. Sharp as a tack and horny for
to be a closeted gay man would give me such an air of mystery that I do not possess now.
Mm, yeah.
I'm just plain old straight.
Wink.
Wink. Wink.
Wink. Wink.
Okay, you're doing live shows across the country. Love it or leave it.
Right.
Well, okay, first of all, the book, Democracy or Else, How to Save America in 10 Easy Steps. It's being released on June 25th.
I got to say one more thing about it. We are donating the proceeds. The profits from the book, we're donating them to Vote Save America.
You fools.
I know.
Oh,
it's so dumb. But we're going to use the money to organize in 2024 and beyond. So this is a book about what people can do. And we want you to know that the money is going to go to organizers and people on the ground doing really good work. So please, I am very proud of the book.
Right.
And the proceeds will go to actual good work. And we have a whole team that vets organizations to find the places where dollars will go the furthest in key races, in key places. So consider it.
Okay. That's great. Thank you for doing that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Love It or Leave It tour.
Hell yeah.
With the simple mission of making you laugh until you forget how old Joe Biden is. That's a lot of laughing. And you're also, you guys are doing live shows across the country with Pot Save America.
That's right.
Pimping that book.
That's
Yeah, you got to get out there and sell that
shit. You got to always be hustling. Always be hustling.
Before we end, this three questions gimmick that we have. What's the main thing you've learned from this, coming this far in your life?
I would say that there is no room, there is no place where everybody's got to figure it out and they're just not telling you. There's nobody with all the answers. Everybody is making it up as they go. If you see something that doesn't make sense to you, incompetence is almost always the better explanation than malevolence. That if you feel like you don't know what you're doing, have no fear.
Yeah.
Everybody else feels the exact same way.
Yeah.
And that can be disempowering.
Yeah.
And it can leave you feeling like nothing matters
or scared.
Or scared.
Or scared that there's no one at the wheel.
We're scared that there's no one at the wheel, or it can lead a lot of people to think, oh, then conspiracy theories, there has to be some explanation. There has to be somebody pulling the strings. Or it can lead you to feel like, you know what? If there's nobody out there who's got a better handle on this than I do, then I can figure it out.
Yeah.
That's what I got.
That's good. And I do think that, like, that's what I always feel about conspiracies. I feel like, have you worked with people? Have you worked with human beings? Have you tried to get things done? And then also keep them secret?
It's impossible.
Bananas.
There's, you think we faked the moon landing? This government
right.
faked the moon landing? Do you see what happened when we tried to make a mask?
Right.
What are you talking about?
Oh, John Lovett, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having
me. It's really been a lot of fun. And I thank all of you for tuning in to this episode of The Three Questions, and I'll be back next week.
The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco production. It is produced by Sean Doherty and engineered by Rich Garcia. Additional engineering support by Eduardo Perez and Joanna Samuel. Executive produced by Nick Liao, Adam Sachs, and Jeff Ross. Talent booking by Paula Davis, Gina Batista, with assistance from Maddie Ogden. Research by Alyssa Grawl. Don't forget to rate and review and subscribe to The Three Questions with Andy Richter wherever you get your podcasts. And do you have a favorite question you always like to ask people? Let us know in the review section.
Can't you tell my love's growing? Can't you feel it ain't it showing? Oh, you must be a-knowing. I've got a big, big love.
This has been a Team Coco production.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places?
Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at the coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.